Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My first guest has an iconic name in the field of comedy. Paula Poundstone was the first female comedian to host the White House Correspondents' Dinner. She's covered both Democratic and Republican national conventions. She voiced a character in the popular animated films Inside Out and Inside Out 2. And she hosts her own weekly podcast, Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone. Paula is also performing live at the Criterion Theater in Medford on March 29th, where I assume a lot of people will listen to Paula Poundstone. Welcome to The Exchange, Paula.
Hey, thanks so much. How are you?
I'm doing great. So your name in the world of comedy is instantly recognizable. But what's the story of how you got into comedy?
I started in Boston in 79. I had gone to see a band, I was bussing tables for a living, so it's not like I turned my back on a law degree. I'd gone to see this band at a place called the Springfield Street Saloon in Inman Square, which eventually became the Ding Ho in Boston. They had a flyer on the wall that said there was comedy there every other Sunday. This was before they even had open mic nights in Boston. I called the phone number on the flyer and eventually got to tell my little jokes there. And at the time, by the way, I had no idea. I don't know how I could have been this stupid, but I had no idea that, like, even Carson at the time, it didn't occur to me that they had material. I thought they were just talking.
It sounds like that's what you do when you get on stage. You engage with your audience, and I don't know if you have a set of jokes. I'm just enjoying the conversation.
I don't have a set per se. Part of the reason for that is that when I did get on stage, I notoriously went over because I would get nervous. I would type up a set of jokes and I would memorize it. If you looked carefully while I was bussing tables, you could see that my lips were moving because I was memorizing. But when I got on, I would get either distracted, but you know, because of nerves, or just plain nerves and couldn't remember, and therefore I was forced to go, "You, sir." in the plaid shirt. What do you do for? And to this day, I use it. At first, I thought it was a liability. At first, I thought it was bad that I did that. And then at some point, I realized that oftentimes, although I think I have good jokes, but that oftentimes that part that was unscripted was the funniest part of the show. And so I just started sort of. I have like a scaffolding that I work with, you know, like I have some place to go if I can't find something in the moment.
When I was looking back at some of your work, you remind me a lot of Robin Williams and that impromptu style where no matter what anyone says, you can just take the conversation in that direction and find humor in it.
Well, thank you. That's nice company to be in. I'm sure because I started in Boston and then I took a Greyhound bus around the country to see what clubs are like in different cities. And I think it was the second night that I was in San Francisco, I went up at a place called The Other Cafe, and I just fell in love with the San Francisco audience. And so I didn't leave. I thought I was going to stay for a couple months, and instead I just never went back to live in Boston. And Robin Williams is from the Bay Area, and so I mean, he was already a big, huge star by this time. And when he was in town, he would drop by the clubs, which he did, by the way, everywhere. I always say anybody, any comic my age or younger owes Robin Williams a debt of gratitude because he sort of reinvigorated audience interest in stand-up in those years. I mean, everybody did what everybody was doing, but I think Robin almost single-handedly really changed audience interest. I mean, comedy, obviously, stand-up comedy has obviously been around since, you know, probably before we came out of the caves. Robin made people come out again, partly because of that frenetic, like, you don't know where he's going to go kind of style. And people came out a lot of times to the clubs in San Francisco because they thought they might see Robin. And in the meantime, they saw the rest of us. And that was good for everybody.
You know, I was perusing the web looking for a lot of your comedy from way back in the day. And I have to admit, I found a video of you on the Stephen Colbert show from 6 years ago. And it was an interesting time in the nation when we had a president. You might recognize his name. It was Donald Trump. And Stephen's first question to you was, what's going on with America right now? And I kind of feel like it's deja vu. So I'm going to ask you, what's going on in America right now?
You know what? I wish I could figure it out. I mean, I remember that what I used to say at the time was that electing Trump was to Americans what beaching themselves was to whales. And it's, you know, I don't think scientists have figured out why whales beach themselves either. And I think it's a mystery why collectively we've done what we've done. I mean, you know, there's a lot of people who think that he, well, now I sound like Trump when I say a lot of people think, but I even know people who have said that they think he snorts Adderall, which I don't think. They say that because sometimes when Trump is talking, he makes a little gesture where he twists ever so slightly with his head and sort of sniffs. And this has led to this speculation that he snorts Adderall. I disagree. I believe that when Putin moves his hand, it's uncomfortable. That's what I think. it's a terrible, terrible pickle. I'm so grateful that I do the job that I do for a living, because I talk politics here and there. I don't consider myself a political comic per se. I consider myself a person who's watching and listening and thinking about what's going on. And my act is largely autobiographical. So I talk about whatever it is I'm watching and listening to and thinking about. And therefore, sometimes at this point in my life, it is it's the mess we're in that I'm thinking about. And so I talk about it, you know, I talk about it some, not as an expert, not as a historian, which I'm not, but just as a, you know, just as a citizen. And boy, is it rough. You know, I remember when I was in the sixth grade, I ran for class president. And you know, it was hard to make a campaign speech because even once in power as the sixth grade class president, one really had very little power because that was before the Supreme Court had made their decisions. And I made a campaign speech wherein I said to the class that I would get the school to give us a soda machine. And a bunch of other kids said the same thing, I think, after they heard me say it. And the teacher took us all aside and she said, "You guys, you can't say that because," now I didn't know I wouldn't be able to do that, but she said, "You can't say that because you wouldn't be able to do that. And so that's not true. And so you can't say it." Which, when you think about that, how little that prepared me for adult politics.
My guest is Paula Poundstone, Paula has starred in several HBO specials, including Cats, Cops, and Stuff, which received a Cable Ace Award for Best Comedy Special. She's had her own TV show, she's produced 5 albums, and she's even written a couple of books, one of which is titled The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. What inspired you to write about the search for human happiness?
Oh, I think it's everybody's quest within their life. And I had this really naive idea about writing a book, which was this. I thought, well, okay, I'll do experiments doing things that I or other people thought would make me happy, which I did. That's what the book is. It's a series of experiments doing things that I or other people thought would make me happy. In order to do that, in order to measure the happiness, I update people in each chapter on what's going on in my life, you know, because you need that ground zero kind of, so that you can see if the happiness rises or falls, or if it's as a result of something else in my life other than the experiment. You know, it's a way of isolating the variables, I feel. And so the book is, it's really a memoir. But I did the experiments legitimately, to the best of my ability. But here's the thing. I had this idea that the publisher would pay for the expenses of whatever the individual experiments were.
That sounds like a good idea.
Sounds like a great idea. Shows how little I know about publishing, because they didn't pay for a lick of anything other than for the book. So that was where the idea came from. And then I paid for the experiments. Some of them didn't cost anything, and then other ones did. I think it's funny because there was, I wrote it several years ago, but I feel like its relevance during these times is immense, because we need to be doing everything we can. I mean, I'm not certain that a lot of what's happening isn't like some sort of mass mental health problem to begin with. I believe there is a cult personality element. I mean, when people are making statues to the guy and, you know, there's bills coming forward about putting his face on Mount Rushmore and making a $250 bill so we can put his face on it. I mean, that all feels cultish. When the guys went to the Republican convention dressed like him, wearing a bandage on their ear like him, that's moving into cult territory. That doesn't have to do with, you know, how to keep the water clean, or, you know, or make sure there's jobs, or lower housing prices. That's just cultish.
It sounds like America's just one big cult.
I don't think all of us are, but I think those kinds of behaviors, that is not just I share a point of view about what to do with the budget. That's something well beyond that, and it's weird. I know this shocks you, but I'm not a trained psychiatrist, so I'm not really qualified to, you know, to diagnose anybody. But I just, as an observer, collectively, it strikes me as cultish, those kinds of things. But having said that, I feel that when we're, you know, in this realm, one of the things that we all need to do is to protect and care for our own mental health. And happiness is a part of caring for your mental health. And so some of the things that I did within the book, some of them were things that other people thought would make you happy. For example, I rent a Lamborghini for a day. I never would have been a believer that a sports car would make you happy, but that's a big American belief that a fancy sports car will somehow do something for you. And the answer is largely no. I did other things that I think did make the, what do you call it? The, the happy chemicals in the brain proliferate, including, and I wish it wasn't this. I wish it was sitting in a chair eating Doritos. But
that's all the time we have. Thanks for talking with us, Paula.
It was great talking with you. Thank you so much.
My guest was Paula Poundstone. She's performing at the Criterion Theater in Medford on March 29th at 7 p.m. Up next, Habitat for Humanity is expanding its critical home repair program in the Rogue Valley. I'm Mike Green.